Constitution as well as the rest of us. However, judging by some of those quizzes, I'd say he's in the running. do you need me to move this up one more? Is it fine right there? Okay. Great. Let's. What I want to do is to go through this, and then I want to take you to our passage for tonight and talk a little bit about why that's important. Okay? Actually, let's start out in our passage, and then I'll show you why it's important. 1 Corinthians, chapter 14. What we have been doing in this passage is looking at how Paul expected the Corinthian church to use maturity to make decisions in what they would and would not do in their church services. What would be important to them, what would be less important to them. Chapter 14, of course, deals quite a bit with tongues. And just to start out all on the same level, I do not believe, and I think the Bible is very plain, tongues are not a gift that is active at this time. Biblical tongues are not being practiced today. People practice something that are called tongues, but I've never once heard a person speak in tongues just as they did in the Bible, which is to speak a language they have never learned. All right? Tongues in the Bible were actual human languages that the speaker had never learned. If that were possible, your pastor would be praying for the gift of tongues and wouldn't get migraines trying to learn 12 of them in Cornell in the last 5 years. All right? That is not how we perceive this passage, and it's quite plain. But at the time this passage was written, tongues were a very viable, credible gift. All right? You have to understand that. Paul isn't saying tongues are bad in this passage. Paul is not saying tongues are wrong. When this passage was written, the Bible hadn't been given in its entirety. And all of these early spiritual gifts were still operating. The spiritual gifts that were later replaced by the Bible are fully in effect before the Bible is completed, before the book of Revelation is written. But what he is saying in this passage is, even in a day and age when tongues are a viable gift, they were not an important gift. And what I'm trying to present with you is Paul is trying to say, not all the gifts are as important as the other gifts. There are gifts that are of great priority, there are gifts that are of lesser priority. I want you, Paul says, to understand what's important for the congregation. And Paul tells them, you have misappropriated the importance of tongues. You've lifted tongues up to an importance up here when, even at a time when it was perfectly valid, tongues was very unimportant on Paul's list. For our purposes, I want us to see how Paul makes that decision. Why does Paul say that tongues are unimportant? And then we can make decisions about the things that we have to do. There are many decisions we make that are not bad and good, that are not right and wrong. There are things that are equally valid, equally possible, equally as moral or immoral, but we have to make a decision about what's better, what's best under these circumstances. This is a great passage for how does a local church make a decision on prioritizing things that are in front of it, using Paul's example of tongues. We looked at several of them, and one of the principles that we saw had to do with edification. Paul said, I want what will build up the church, what will cause the church to have a deeper understanding. I want the church to always lift up those gifts that help the church to understand my word better. Particularly tonight in verse 6. But now, brethren, if I come to you speaking with tongues, what shall I profit you? Unless I speak to you either by revelation, by knowledge, by prophesying, or by teaching. Even things without life, whether a flute or a harp, when they make a sound, unless they make a distinction in the sounds, how will it be known what is piped? What is played, what's piped on the flute, what's played on the harp. If a trumpet makes an uncertain sound, who will prepare for battle? Thank you, those of you who played tonight, giving me my example for what we'll talk about. Also, by the way, those of you in the choir, Does this passage have anything to do with singing distinctly? Does this passage have anything to do with making sure you're well understood when you make a distinction in your sounds? Promised the choir I'd be speaking about that tonight, and it has something to say about that. So likewise you, unless you utter by the tongue words easy to understand, how will it be known what is spoken? For you will be speaking into the air. We're going to talk about some principles tonight that Paul uses to say tongues are not of value to the congregation when they're compared to other gifts. Their value is limited. But the overall principle that we're going to see three examples of tonight is Paul says, a overriding principle in what you do, it must be able to be understood. Whatever you do in a church, if you want to edify the church, what you do must be understood by the listeners. You with me so far? Very, very plain. When we see Paul talking about tongues, Paul doesn't say tongues are evil, tongues are wrong. Paul says later, I speak in tongues more than all of you. But that's back when tongues were a valid gift. But he said the problem is that tongues are not able to be understood by all of the people sitting there. Therefore, they're of limited value. The things you should lift up to the highest priority, the things that should be important to you, are those ministries that follow the principle of making the people understand what's going on. Understandability is key, is prime. Come back to our Constitution. What concerns me is not whether or not you have memorized the Constitution. All right? Constitution is what we use as a way of expressing how we'll govern ourselves. We don't live by the Constitution, we live by the Bible. The Constitution is just our expression of what we think the Bible requires of us. What concerns me is the Constitution able to be understood? Is the Constitution understood by the people, and is it able to be understood? Because this principle teaches me that anything you do in a church, whether it's the music you sing, the preaching that you do, a bulletin board that you put up, a church sign you put out in front of the church, or a document like the Constitution, it's got to be understandable. It's got to be accessible to the people. The people have to understand the distinctions that you're making. That's a key principle. And so when we have preaching, if the preaching isn't understandable, it's not biblical preaching. Now, there's all kinds of good preaching, but if it's not understandable, we don't put a priority on it. We'll come back to that in a moment. Singing. Is the singing in the church understandable? Now, you have to back off a minute. Unless you have an ability in music, an experience in music, you won't have the same understanding of the music that people who are musicians have. Musicians have a deeper understanding of the music than the untutored do. They know what's going on. They know about themes. They know what's working together. They've had experience. That's not the point. The point is, do we put as a priority in this church that music should be understandable to the people? That means when the words are sung, are the words important? Now, by the way, I think that words and whatever music the words are set to are both important. I'm not all in favor of saying they've got great content but horrible music. The year I graduated from BBC, they were sending out, I think, like 7 different singing groups authorized by the school. One of the groups, we were looking at a group to come down for one of our youth rallies. And so the school said, we'll send you a good group. They sent us a group that was called the Sound Doctrine Octet. It's like, oh no. Sound Doctrine Octet makes them sound like the most boring group that I've ever heard. Like, oh please, can't you send the Harmon Airs or somebody who, you know, can carry a tune quartet or anything? But actually they came and their doctrine was sound. Now, I will say that for them. I don't know about anything else, but their doctrine was sound. Well, both are important, but in a church, we put a priority on the understandability of the music. Do you understand what's being said? Do you understand what the music is trying to accomplish? Those things are key. In our Constitution, The priority is it able for you to understand it? Now, if you don't understand it because you haven't had the time or because you've had other things to do or it's not that great a document to you, that's okay. But if the Constitution is written in such a way that it is hard to understand, that it's inaccessible, that's our problem. Okay? If the church is not working at making its documents, its statement of faith, its constitution, its church covenant accessible, helping you to understand them, that's our problem. We're not fulfilling the understandability priority of Scripture. If, as a church, you don't understand what's happening in baptism or the Lord's table, that's my problem as a pastor. That's a burden that's laid on me to explain the ordinances to you. And so something, what I'm trying to do, we'll go through some of these just briefly, but what I'm trying to do is more a test for myself. How well do you understand the Constitution? And then the next question being, if you don't understand it well, why? We've worked very hard at making the Constitution very plain, putting it into plain, simple English that you can understand, making sure that the Constitution represents what we're doing now, not what we might have been doing 100 years ago, simplifying it, taking out anything that's unnecessary. We can perhaps do better on getting it into your hands and doing other things, but answers to some of these. How many positions are filled by congregational election at the annual business meeting? Recite them off to me. Deacons, treasurer, clerk, financial secretary. One other, auditor. Okay, technically, auditors are not an office, but we do elect auditors. So four or five, depending on how you're counting. Either one of those would be acceptable. We changed that. We used to elect buku. I don't know the number, 16, 17, 18. Whether we did right or not, we did change it to simplify it. And it used to be before, if you asked people how many people did we elect, I wouldn't have expected them to know. But now, when it's only four or five, we should be able to know that. What percentage of vote is required to call a pastor? Minority. 80%. A majority, yeah, minority vote. 80%. Now, hey, you got that one right. Well, good. I'll be checking. I'll know which one's yours now. If nobody else looks. 80%. That may be important to you in a few months. That particular figure may be important to you. We won't take time to discuss it now, but 80% is a reasonable figure. If I was a pastor and found out that I only got 77% of a church vote, I wouldn't go there. If a church wants to call a pastor with the 70% vote, that would make me nervous as a pastor. I would want to know what was happening, and I wouldn't go. So 80%, we set a higher figure, never 100%, but it's an 80% of those members present and voting. How much money can the deacons expend, no deacons on this one, or wives, how much money can the deacons expend without a congregational vote? How many know this one who are not deacons or wives? Guess. 500 is a good guess. Now, we've always talked on the Board of Deacons about whether that's enough money or not. Things cost more than they used to. That figure. And you want the deacons to have the ability to spend enough money to fix things as they come up and to deal with items so they don't have to come to the church, but you don't want the deacons spending money, that a large enough sum of money that the congregation would say, wait a minute, I wanted some input on that one. But right now in our Constitution, it's $500. Yes?
All around that one.
Yes?
Is there anything in the Constitution about the deacons fund?
Nothing right now, except it says that the deacons fund will not be audited. We do have a mention of the Deacons Fund. Deacons Fund is the money that we give on nights when we have the Lord's Supper, and it's distributed solely at the discretion of the deacons for needs within the church and other things. And that it's only, the balance is kept by the clerk of the deacon board, and the deacons expend that money and among themselves, and they never account for every expenditure to the church because it's more discreet. But the only place our Constitution that I'm aware mentions it is it says that that fund is not subject to an audit, that fund isn't, otherwise it wouldn't be discreet if other people knew how much money was given. Okay, what percentage of vote is required to amend the Constitution? Two-thirds. Two-thirds. Why that amount? Well, because when you change your constitution, it shouldn't be easy to do. On the other hand, it shouldn't be nigh unto impossible to do. But two-thirds to amend the Constitution, and of course you've got to announce the constitutional change for at least 2 weeks prior in a special business meeting. What we have done when we amended the Constitution is read it in one business meeting and then amend it in the next. We haven't tried, we presented the church lots and lots of time to see what we're trying to do. Who is on the pulpit committee that searches for a new pastor? Deacons. And? Trick question. And no one. Okay, trick question. Deacons and deacons. All right. Now, I've talked with the deacons. If they would like help from the pastor will give it. But the pastor, current pastor, is not on the next pulpit committee automatically. Only the deacons, okay, and not their wives. Only the deacons are on the pulpit committee.
Back one step.
Yes.
I'm doing a change in the Constitution.
Right.
That people attending the meeting.
Yes. Two-thirds of those members present and voting. Present and voting, which doesn't count abstentions. All right? So present and voting at any meeting, two-thirds can change the Constitution. Okay? Pulpit committee is just the deacons. Okay? No one else but the deacons. Can someone be a member of this church and a member of another church at the same time? Yes. What do we call that? Watch care. I'll come back. Watch care membership. We put it in the Constitution a year ago. We started it. What is watch care membership all about, by the way?
If someone is here as a student, perhaps, and they want to maintain their membership in their home church.
Exactly.
They still want to have a place to come and fellowship and worship. And
exactly. For students, perhaps, for military, for people who want to be part of the church and participate, because many things in the church we do limit to members, but at the same time, they're not here all year long or they're back and forth. We do have a watch care membership that allows for that. Let me go back. Mary, what was your question?
Why is the deacon on the pulpit?
Two reasons for that. One, it's smart.
Okay.
One of the things that you find is in a pastor, number one is you want continuity. You want a pastor who represents the basic beliefs and values of the church. In order for you to do that, the people who look for the pastor are people who have been selected primarily for their spiritual insight. And there is only one office other than pastor in the church that the prime candidates for selection is spiritual insight, and that is deacons. You want a limited number doing it. You want a deacon board doing it that is smaller. The larger your pulpit committee, the harder the process is. You also want a group of people doing it who have some idea and understanding of the history of the church. When I talked to a church, when I talked to this church before I came, I wanted to know where does the church stand on this and where does the church stand on that. Well, that takes people who know more about the church, perhaps even than the members do. That takes people who know where the history of it is. I want to know, quite frankly, what the strengths and weaknesses of the church are. I want to know what happened to the last pastor. Is he still alive, or where have you buried the body? I want to know questions like, how are your finances doing? Where do you stand financially? I want to know, they're the people that as a pastor, when I come, I have to work with. Those are questions, and by the way, many of the things that the pulpit committee does require extraordinary discretion. You are finding things out about men when you're doing a search that perhaps you wouldn't want everybody to know. What if you disqualify a man for one reason or another? The pulpit committee is really doing something similar to what the deacons do when they work with discipline, for instance. Also, just in terms of wisdom, churches that have pulpit committee that come from different people within the church, you know, we'll take one from here and one from there, you would be amazed to find the politicking that goes on at those pulpit committee meetings. I can tell you, I've talked with pastors. One church in our area, Cortland, Bible Baptist in Cortland, just went through that. And all of a sudden, this group and this person and this one here, and you get all kinds of people with, well, this is what I want in the next pastor, and this is what I want in the next pastor, and we really need to do this. The point is, there is one group of people that you elected for discernment's sake. If you didn't, get busy and do it. You elected the deacons to do that. Now, all the deacons do is they cull through, find candidates, cull through those candidates, arrange for them to speak, check into their background, recommend them to the church, and the church votes. All right? It's the church that makes the decision. All right? And sometimes you can guess correctly. I understand there are at least two people that were presented to the church last time, and you voted no, correct? Didn't we talk about that last time? There at least, and there was one person that you recommended to the church that the church voted for, and it took a moment to consider it, and then said, no, I don't think I'm called. It's a long process. The deacons don't choose the next pastor, all right? The congregation doesn't even choose the next pastor. It's really the Lord that uses many factors to do it. But you do want your pulpit committee to be your deacons. Don't ever change that, because you need that stability. You need that continuity when you're going from pastor to pastor. And you find that once you open that up, you can get yourself into some pretty awkward situations. And they're the people that were elected with that requirement. They're not the only people in the church with discernment, but they were the people that were elected for discernment's sake. So use them. A couple others real quick, and then I'll get back to our passage. Yes, you can be a member of this church and a member of another church at the same time, called Watch Care membership. What percentage of active members makes a quorum? We just talked about this. 10%. I want to change that. 10% of the members as a quorum is much too little. We spent a whole Wednesday night talking about that. We will spend a Sunday night talking about it. Then I'll talk to the deacons about it. Then we'll present something. We'll do a lot of talking, but we will change that to something that is more biblical. Are inactive members members in good standing? Yes. Yes. We have two kinds of members. Members in good standing, members not in good standing. Those members in good standing are active and inactive. Inactive members are good standing members. They're just not able to be here for whatever reason to make up a quorum. They're not able to be here for whatever reason to vote. They're not able to be here for whatever reason to serve. They would be people like Winnie Snow. They would be people like Mrs. Steiger. People who are not able to be here, but at the same time, they're not under discipline. We're not; they just can't be here. So we want our active voting membership to be those who are able to be here and those who are able to serve. And so inactive membership has nothing to do with discipline. That's an entirely different process. How many deaconess positions are there? As many as deacons. Okay, so if we have six deacons, we have six deaconess positions. If we have nine deacons, which we have now, we have nine deaconess positions. Deaconess positions are filled first, the wives of deacons, but in our case right now, we have one deacon who does not have a wife, that being Dave Risley, and the deaconesses can, at their discretion or not at their discretion, vote for any given year to replace or to fill up that extra position, depending on how they're organized and what the particular needs are. So we have nine positions for deaconess, and any given year we may have nine deaconesses or however many that are filling those spots. If there is a question of constitutional interpretation, who renders final judgment? Deacons. Deacons. Okay, now that's a tough one. The reason for that is twofold. One, you do not want the congregation at any given meeting interpreting the Constitution. You don't want to come to a given meeting and do that. You have a group of people who are chosen by the church, who are trustees of the church, who do that. How does the congregation interpret the Constitution? What is that process called? Two-thirds majority can amend. The congregation interprets the Constitution by amending it, by having the whole congregation there, by explaining it to them, and you don't want a Constitution that can be interpreted quickly, changed quickly. But when you're at a meeting, especially your constitution are for when things go wrong. You need a smaller group of people who have been elected by the church who can do that on the spot. That is the deacon board. Now, the deacon board, of course, can be overridden by the congregation. It's called amendment. They can say, we want something different. That is the wrong way to interpret the Constitution. But you need a group who can interpret the Constitution on the spot who are also not the congregation or that particular group of the congregation who happens to be there on a given night. And so when we're talking about interpretation of the Constitution, it is quite a bit like in the United States. We have a group of people who interpret the Constitution. They are called Supreme Court. They interpret the Constitution. The people can amend the Constitution at any point, make it plain, but the people who interpret that are the Supreme Court justices. And our bonus question, what is, according to our statement of faith, the true center of Christian unity? The Bible. We say that the unity we have is found here. This is the true center of Christian unity. Okay. I will see how these work out. The principle that we'll be dealing with next week and one more week after that we need to understand is the principle of understandability. It's not a question of being right or wrong. Who knows? When we get to heaven, we'll find out if we're right or wrong. The burden that's laid upon us is everything that we do has to be understandable. Even the sign we have out front. We don't have a sign with a lot of information on it. Do you know why that is? Exactly. When we were talking, the deacons who were on the board, remember? We were talking, you're driving by at 55 miles an hour, ready to be arrested at the bottom of the hill when it turns 45. You drive by a church sign, how much can you read? No, I've seen church signs that have, you know, this week's message, this week's offering, you know, this week's pastor, all of those pieces of information. But when we looked at it, we said, when people are coming by, we need a sign that is easy to read. That is why, what is the lettering on that sign? It's glow in the dark. When your light shines it, it's intelligibility. Even that principle in terms of the sign was important to us. That idea that what we do has to be easily understood. It went into that. It goes into our Constitution. Everything that we do, now we might not have applied that perfectly to all areas because we haven't reached heaven yet, but that is a principle, and it's one that we're working on in our Constitution, making sure that what we have written is able to be understood by you. And then we'll work from there. Let's take our hymnals. Okay, can we return? Mr. Mark, would you close us in prayer tonight?
Father, thanks so much for the opportunity to be able to join together this evening, Father, as we came once again to worship you, Father. It's been more of an educated time more than anything else. We're so thankful for that, Father. We thank you for Pastor Smith and the ministry of Brookendale here and all that you're doing. And I just ask that as we go home this night that you challenge our hearts even by the things we've learned about the Constitution, Father, the principles that we looked at in 1 Corinthians 13 and 14, Father. And I pray that you keep us safe this night. Help us have a good night's rest. A good week this week. In Jesus' name.
Amen. You're dismissed.